Hello and welcome to Dvorak Horowitz Unplugged, an hour-long discussion of activity in the financial markets around the world, featuring columnist John C. Dvorak and money manager Andrew Horowitz. This conversation is casual and unrehearsed. Let's join John and Andrew now.
I'm John C. Dvorak.
I'm Andrew Horowitz.
And here we are on May 17th, another episode of the Dvorak Horowitz Unplugged.
Unseasoned.
Unseasoned.
Unsavory.
So a couple of things happened this week. I think markets have been acting a little odd.
Yeah.
Like it's at the top, maybe ready to collapse.
I don't know. Collapse. I mean, these collapses these days are 2%. There's always it seems to be a bidder right now with the easy money, right? Doesn't there? I mean, it almost seems like every single time it comes down, there's like a quick bidder underneath.
So we were watching, the two of us, a Financial Times video of a guy who apparently picked the last top. I mean, there's always somebody out there who's done, you know, hit the last thing right on the money. And so they assume, you know, of course, people are guessing left and right about one thing or another. And everyone's, you know, somebody's bound to get lucky. And so when they do, they're now the experts until they are proven wrong. And he is now saying, I don't have his name in front of me, sorry.
Russell Napier.
Yeah, he's saying that the big collapse. Well, of course, I think there's a big collapse coming too, not tomorrow. But he's saying S&P 400.
Yeah.
That's a pretty big drop.
That, what is that, like 70%? It's below where it was last by, a good 30% lower than the last time when it went down in 2009. But you know, it's kind of fascinating. This is, a guy who supposedly called the top. And by the way, as you get through the video, which is about 11 minutes of a lot of dry English chatter, right? Of course, he has a book and a course that he has available.
There's always a book.
Yeah, and a course. Now, I don't know what the course teaches you. If he believes that in the next couple of years, whatever, that this thing is going to collapse, I'm not sure what you're going to have a course for. It's pretty much either stay out or be short. It's what else are you going to do?
I don't know. I mean, it sounds like a short opportunity. Well, he says that when it hits 400, it's a buying opportunity. Well, I would think if you have any money.
Right, exactly.
It's like that's the problem with these buying opportunities.
He's very obviously doom and gloom and talked about how, he was right about the top was coming down. And then somewhere along the line, he had a bottom coming up. And he used these statistics that are based on PE ratios and some other historical data that he uses. But you know what? The problem is that he may be right eventually. And if he is right, by the way, we're talking serious catastrophe. We're talking about companies, S&P 500, companies out of business all over the place.
Yeah.
We're talking about, Apple at $25. We're talking about joblessness rates that's going to be out of control. We're going to talk about, banks just going under, the world just imploding. I mean, if he falls to 400, even if it takes a long time to get there, it's going to be a pretty ugly looking scenario.
Yeah, I would think.
But I'll tell you something, doom and gloom sells, all kidding aside, because everybody out there really, oftentimes talks about all the opportunities, but there's that grouping of people that likes to hear about the real negative, the real super negative, and that really, the bunker mentality. That really sells subscriptions. I know some people have made quite a bit of money on that.
Yeah, well, the downside does sell. Yeah. And the upside, it's just – you might as well just turn on CNBC if you want that.
Right. It's supposed to be an upside.
It's free. Yeah. It's supposed to be upside.
Right. There's supposed to be upside. That's the normal course. You want to be the one that fights the crowd for the historic and epic blast down – so that you're the only one left with money in the end. And you'll be the king of your little fiefdom.
Well, you can make money on the short side, but calling the tops is, I think, non-trivial. It's easier just to, go hope for the long. And although I'd have to say that since 2000, I don't see that anybody from the peaks of 99 or so. It's just basically gotten back to where it was.
There's a few people that have called the top. There's a guy named Doug Cass who called the bottom, generational bottom, in the S&P 500. And since then, he's called about 25 or 30 tops. Now, I'm not sure what that means.
How many did he hit?
Well, none yet, it seems.
Right? Well, I mean, you keep calling it, you're going to hit one eventually.
Yeah.
And then you go out and you say, I called the top and I called the bottom. You just cite the two. You know, this reminds me of the guys who set up these scam websites, and you predate, you know, a bunch of – I'm thinking of doing this just as a gag, setting up a website, you know, called Dvorak Predicts or something like that, and then predating all the posts, calling every top and bottom right on the money.
Nice.
And then you look at it, and you go back, you know, to 2008, and you see – you get the date, and I'm predicting the crash of the housing market and why. And it's all – but it's, and the date is right. It says, you know, whatever, April, you know, 2008, my post. And then I go tell people that, look at this. You can check it out.
Right.
Go see for yourself. I'm nailing it left and right. And here's my book, you know, buy the book. I do have a book, by the way, but it's not going to be based on that kind of bogus crap. But I can see doing that, and it would be
it's just like the old – we've talked about the old boiler room scam. You take 10 people.
Oh, right. This is a classic. Right. This is what they do with sports betting is notorious for pulling this scam.
Yeah, you take 10 people and you say – you split them up, five and five. You call a five and say, listen, I'm an expert in gold. You know, I want to tell you something. Don't do this, but I'm just going to tell you so you can get a kind of a feeling for how good I am at this. Next week, gold is going to be up. You call the other five set of people and you say, next week, gold is going to be down. And then whichever one you're right with, you call them back and you split them up again, maybe, you know, two and three or whatever. And you say again, gold is going to be up to part of them. Gold's going to be down. By the second round that you're right, you got them eating out of your hand. Whatever you say next, they'll buy from you.
Right. And of course, you don't do it with 10 people. You do it with hundreds. Right.
Exactly.
And this is what is done with sports betting. It's a notorious scam. You just tell people to, you know, bet on this team or that team, and it's very easy to do. And you hit about three of these in a row, and then you because then you can put the hard sell on. You got the guy on the phone. He said, geez, I hit three of these dead on, right? Am I right? Am I right? You notice this, right? Have you seen this? Am I right? Yeah. You get them to agree. And then once they're in agreement, you say, well, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go, you know, bet on this thing, and then you take their money.
Mm, very nice. So you, of course, we're watching the – there's so many interesting things that happened this week. I guess the probably the most – well, I don't know if it's interesting, startling, or maybe it's par for the course, or maybe there is a little bit of a potential conspiracy behind this. But Hewlett-Packard, there was a leaked memo from Leo Apothecary, the CEO.
Apothecary.
Yeah. Yeah, probably. Yeah, exactly. He used to work for Rite Aid. And from Leo, the CEO, there was a memo that went to management that basically summed it up that says, hey, we're going to be having a very tough quarter. We need to watch every penny because next quarter is going to be very difficult, et cetera. Somehow, mysteriously, it was released. And this was towards the end of the day on Monday. Earnings were supposed to be on Wednesday. And all of a sudden, the stock starts cratering on Monday. So late in the day, after hours, they decide they're going to put an emergency earnings announcement out on Tuesday morning in order to maybe fend off whatever concerns there were. So now you got to think that maybe it was something wrong with the memo. But they didn't deny that there was a memo. They didn't deny the memo was wrong. You know, the memo was a fake or anything wrong with it. That comes out. They come out with their earnings. And lo and behold, there was a very tough quarter, they predicted. Stock was off about 9.5% at one point for HP. That's pretty significant. The chart looks terrible. They didn't say anything about, you know, how this leak happened, why it happened, apologizing for it. Really a terrible, terrible execution. And I wonder, you know, there's some bad blood between the Oracle fellows there and HP now, right?
Yeah.
You think maybe there was something with one of some of the people management maybe over at HP that was still loyal to Mark Hurd?
Yeah, it could be.
I mean, I don't know. It just seems very odd that somebody would have leaked this.
Well, somebody may have shorted the company before they leaked it. That's always a possibility.
Yeah. And
that's the way. I think a lot of this stuff. stems from, you know, I think some investigation is needed, although you can always do stuff offshore. Yeah, the thing cratered. It was amazing. The stock went from almost 42 down to mid-30s, like it's 37 or 36, something like that.
Yeah, it was 49 in the beginning of, well, say the end of February when their last earnings announcement came out. I wonder when he took over. He took over this year, right? Maybe last year. Stock has not done well since then.
No.
I mean,
it's
really
done
poorly.
Very poorly. It looks like it's setting itself up for a bottom that could be a good investment point.
Well, the problem, though, is that you have this interesting tale of companies right now. You have some companies in the same sector doing the same thing that are doing
like
very
Dell.
Well. Yeah, Dell. Listen, you knew that Dell was going to – it just was setting up that Dell was going to surprise. Now, they were light, by the way, on revenue. They were light on revenue. Their PC division looked awful. But they had their cloud division. They recently picked up that a couple of different companies, but that's doing well. And they cut expenses extraordinarily. The outlook was very good for growth of revenue and growth of sales to be better. And the projections were very good. Now, you're looking at HP and you're looking at Dell. And Dell clearly has been trying to trim down their less profitable areas like personal and consumer. But my gosh, I mean, there is a big differential. What about IBM and HP? I mean, they're pretty closely aligned.
Yeah.
You know, server-based, they have some services. They have.
I know, they're almost identical, actually, in the model.
Right. So you have that. You have Apple, which, of course, has, you know, units, a product.
Yeah, Apple's, I think, a different animal altogether. I don't like to throw Apple into anything because they have their stores. They move their product through stores. Their channels are all different. They have all kinds of consumer items. They have some computers. It's not even important to them anymore. Apple is completely out of the picture for comparison purposes.
Look at this chart that I sent you, though. Do you see the drop-off back in February to about 43? See where it went from about 47 down to 43?
What? I'm looking.
The link I gave you.
Oh, the link. Let's see. Where is that? Utilities.
No, the link right at the storyline right there, which is HP.
Oh, at the beginning. The chart is awful, it says.
Yeah, and click that.
Okay. Ooh. Yeah, there's a big dagger over here. Ooh, not good.
But what's interesting is it dropped off back in, I guess that was back in.
End of February.
End of February. And on a daily basis, it was below its 200-day moving average. It can never get above its 200-day moving average.
Nope.
It's 50-day moving average.
Every time it bumped it, it went back down.
Right. And this is during a time that was pretty reasonably good for tech stocks from March through April.
Yeah, it bumped it again, and now it took a huge tumble.
Yeah, now it's below its 50. But it's a goner.
It's a goner. It's a goner. Get out. Run.
Let me tell you what this is called. This is called deep value. If you're a deep value player and you have a long-term time horizon, which is fine. There's plenty of opportunity for that, right?
Yeah, well, some people with a lot of money and they don't have time to deal with the market, they have to look for this.
Yeah, and then you look at like a Cisco. Isn't the story the same with Cisco?
Is it? Is it really?
I mean,
Well, it probably is. I mean, Cisco.
Look at that stock. It looks identical. Cisco probably looks worse.
Well, let's take a look. I'm on this thing.
Just change the symbol there to Cisco.
What is this? Cisco's what? CSCO?
CSCO, yeah. So this stock does the same routine back in February.
I just wrote a column about, oh, this Cisco's bumped. Are you kidding me? This stock looks terrible.
I understand.
I mean, it's a mess.
Yeah, it's bad. It's actually hitting up on multiple bottoms here, but it is, again, deep value.
Yeah, you're probably right. You're probably right. This is probably, when is it going to hit the bottom, though? I mean, it's like, the problem with deep value, the way you describe it, and when you look at a stock like this, you just got to go, you know, if you buy it at 16, could you have picked it up at 8?
Right. I mean, the problem is going to be is if the markets roll over, this is going to continue to get hit, but maybe not as hard because it already got hit.
Oh, yeah, it's in the tank.
And the value players will give you the line that it could only get better from here. There is so much negative sentiment and so much negative outlook that is already priced into the stock.
Could be a buck for all you know. What do you mean get better?
I agree. I understand.
So I wrote a column about Cisco. I think it ran in MarketWatch describing their ills because I had talked about the company having potential, I think, 6 months ago in the same column, basically discussing the fact that with IP6 coming on stream, there was all kinds of opportunities for a company like Cisco to make hay. Then I came to the conclusion in a more recent column that the problem with Cisco is they have no marketing whatsoever. They're one of those high-tech companies. Microsoft is in the same category. They have no, you know, real marketing muscle. They have nobody knows what they're doing in so far as true marketing is concerned. I mean, they can sell products. They can find a government buyer and have some slick operator go in there and sell them product. But they don't have any way of – they have no general marketing strategy whatsoever, which leaves the opportunity open for somebody who actually knows marketing to pick up this company. You know, in other words, Chambers would have to go because he's obviously the problem when it comes to marketing. But he goes and some marketing guy comes in. I've seen this happen with other high-tech companies in particular. And somebody comes in and actually knows how to, you know, market as opposed to sell. You end up with a skyrocket.
Mm-hmm. You know, you would think that the Cisco marketing should have been an automatic, though, that because of – now, they don't have any sexy products. They had that flip video thing that was all done to help consumption so that they could benefit. But you would think that with all of the increase in bandwidth requirements from from phones and devices and, you know, everything out there, that the marketing should have been built in from those other companies like an Apple that were already marketing a product that was a hog of bandwidth, and that should have just automatically moved Cisco's products. That should have been the case.
That's what you kind of think on the outset, but when it comes to actual marketing, you have to do something as opposed to just passively sitting back and taking orders, which is what you're describing.
Right.
You know, you're assuming that this and that's going to happen, and all they have to do is, you know, hook up the phones and put somebody there answering the phones, and they're in business. This is the kind of Cisco really suffers from this problem, and I don't see that changing at all. I mean, my examples were the Linksys products. They're all overpriced. Yeah. And there's no benefit to owning a Linksys over a Netgear or some weird unknown brand from China. There's no benefit. They don't do anything special.
And more importantly, a lot of these cable companies and internet companies are packaging their routers and their wireless routers into the actual modem. Now, some of those are supplied by Cisco, of course. But at the same time, you know, it's just the barriers to entry. And I think even Chambers admitted this on his conference call. The barriers to entry into that business are not very high.
Yeah.
So I did listen to the Dell conference call for a while today. And as I was listening to the Dell conference call, they're getting into it. And then they're talking about how they're really expanding and into more corporate and cloud. And then all of a sudden the call goes dead. I'm thinking – then it comes on, the operator, we're having technical difficulties. I'm thinking, oh boy. Then Dell comes back on. Then it goes off again. And then it comes, and they started from the beginning of the conference call, like from a recording or something like that. And this went on for like 5-6 minutes. It was very annoying. But consumers were very weak. That was the takeaway. Hmm. Big takeaway.
Well, I've talked about this too, and I think consumers are weak in tech, especially PCs. And by the way, I recently bought a Dell for the family, a cheap $299 discounted, you know, in their sale room online, $299 machine that is just a dynamite product.
Mm-hmm.
Quiet, fast, it's amazing. Anyway, the problem I think is almost like with the car industry where you don't have a lot of repair shops anymore because cars are just better made. They go 100,000 miles with, I mean, you take a Lexus or a Toyota. The thing goes for 200,000 miles or more without really needing a lot of work. And these newer computers are just last longer than they did in the 80s. I mean, in the 1980s, they weren't made as – I mean, they were made as well as they could be made, but they, you know, they were made obsolete within a couple of years. These new machines aren't that way. I mean, I think that's the problem. It's not like there's a lack of interest. Meanwhile, I'm looking at the Dell chart.
Yes. Let me get there.
What am I looking at?
Let's see.
It's like the opposite of the HP chart.
Well, I think you had Dell much further along. Very choppy, by the way. You had HP, Dell much further along on the deep value cycle, it's doomed cycle back in February.
Yeah.
And then it went sideways. They bought.
What's the dotted line I'm seeing?
The dotted line is a 20-day moving average.
Okay. It goes up and below. Never mind.
Well, I'll tell you what it does do, though. It does follow the top line of that purple area, right? and the bottom line.
Is that a Bollinger band, the top?
That's the Bollinger, right, it's a Bollinger band. The Bollinger bands are standard, two standard deviations away from the 20-day on either side.
Okay, so it's kind of like hanging, bumping, just hanging in with the Bollinger band, except till the last couple of days.
Right, and then it it's going to turn up. It's up about 5%, which overnight, which is just going to take back some of the losses today to 1670, I think, or something like that. 1680 was the recent high on it, and that's good. But you know, clearly there was a much different momentum going on. They're really trying to cut down. But it's clear that they beat. By the way, they beat EPS by 11 cents, and that was, I think, by about 40% beat, some or 30% beat, and that was pretty outstanding. But again, on lower revenue. So they're obviously doing a lot of cost cutting, tremendous cost cutting. There's no question about that. You hear about these watermelons in China?
Yeah. Well, not until you mentioned it.
This is great.
But apparently, this bothers me, by the way, these sorts of stories. I'm going to read from this little clip. Watermelons in eastern China's Jiangsu province burst in the fields, possibly because of a growth-promoting chemical and sudden rainfall after a drought, according to the Xinhua news agency. More than 115 acres of melons, which is a lot, in the Danyang city area were ruined. It's an accelerant called 4-chlorfenuron, which is I looked it up. It's listed as a pesticide. But apparently it's used on grapes and other things to make them grow bigger. And I guess they used it to get the melons bigger. And then when it rained, the melons just all blew up.
This has got to be quite the sight.
This stuff's it's a toxic chemical, and it kills fish when it gets into the water. It has all these problems. And according to the Chinese, the farmers all deny using it.
Yeah.
But that's typical of some of these mid to low level Chinese producers. They lie.
I'm not trying to be. I hope I'm not being. Or maybe I am being naive. I am being naive. What happens with this 4-chlorfenuron, which is an accelerant that caused these watermelons to explode, hits my body and I drink a glass of water? Seriously.
Boom. There you go. What happened to Andrew?
He
drank some water. He had some of that stuff in him. He just blew up.
Yeah, watermelon explosion. No, but really, I mean, is this safe stuff?
No, it's not. It's obviously not safe. Right. I'm still reading because I just found out about this, before the show, and so I'm going to look into it. It might be something I'll discuss in detail on the No Agenda show. I'm not sure, but this
150 acres.
This is the kind of thing that you keep hearing about in China, and the Chinese government can't really crack down on because these things float around. I mean, there's a black gray market for the chemicals, and these guys are doing what they can to make a living. I don't know. You also about the empty cities, which has been discussed for the last couple of years.
Right. Did you see that video?
Yeah. That's nothing compared to the overhead, the satellite photos. There's about three or four of these ghost cities that the Chinese have built. And they're huge. I mean, they're huge. They're, like half the size of Manhattan. They're like the size of Chicago. And they're built from scratch. They got museums, sports stadiums, all kinds of skyscrapers. People can look up ghost cities, China, in Google, and you'll get photos that are just fantastic. I mean, you get to see all kinds of stuff. And there's like basically four of these, maybe more, and some smaller ones. And they're abandoned because they're actually set up for a future growth spurt, and they get that so they can shove people into these towns. But many of them have been abandoned for so long that the maintenance issues are becoming a problem. The paint's chipping and the roads have got weeds coming through them. It's really weird. It's a weird, weird story, and is kind of just discussed on the as a sidelight. It's weird. Well,
Bloomberg's doing a whole series on this now.
Are they?
Yeah, so that's where that came from. The Bloomberg's doing a whole series on the...
Oh, right. It was a Bloomberg video.
Yeah.
You're right.
And it's actually because you have Jim Chanos, who has been very vocal. He's a hedge fund manager. He does a lot of shorting. He's very vocal about the impending bursting of the bubble of the Chinese property situation. And, being so vocal about it, by the way, is kind of interesting. Do you wonder if being so vocal has created an understanding by the Chinese, and that's why they're not only why, but one of the, you know, they're much more aware of what's going on, and maybe we'll stop that. But the these kind of situations, you know, even if there is all of these ghost towns, if the Chinese government is building them and it's their dime, that's one thing. If it's developers that's on their dime, it's another thing. And if it's consumers that are buying these things, it's entirely a different circumstance.
Well, it's not very well understood because I've been trying to follow this. It's not easy. I'm going to have to get some contacts in China, I think, that can explain it. Or some. There's got to be somebody that can really just boil it down. But I think it's a combination of things. And I know for one fact that crops up every so often is that the a lot of Chinese that have middle-class Chinese that have now got enough money to buy a house have been buying a second or third home as an investment property, kind of like people do here occasionally. And so there's a lot of extra inventory of houses out there, and right. And I think, and then with these ghost cities which could house millions of people. Even though I think it'd be kind of interesting if you can get in there and buy something cheap and just live there until it falls apart. Anyway, it seems to me that there is a bubble that is reminiscent of the Hong Kong bubble, which occurred, I believe, in the late 90s or mid-90s, where they
have the same situation. I mean, their properties are going for ridiculous sums. There's a new mall that is going to be some exorbitant price after they did something about a restructuring of the mall. The price per square foot is out of control in Hong Kong, not the retail space. It's going to be like the most expensive retail space in the world.
Yeah, Hong Kong had this bubble before the absorption into the Chinese economy, and then which crashed the market, and then it seems to be reemerging with the same problem. Hong Kong is problematic in terms of the prices of property there. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's impossible for people to deal with, you know, outsiders.
Right.
So it's the same. It's kind of like, you know, California property where you can have an expensive house because you bought a cheap house years ago and you just ratcheted.
Right.
And I think that happens in Hong Kong. But at some point, you know, you can't ratchet any higher. And then if some little thing happens, the next thing you know, everything's in the tank. I don't know. I find it peculiar. Well, it's just not good.
It's a problem. I mean, if they control it as a government is one thing, but again, they're trying to rein it in, and you're not allowed to buy a third house at this point. Speculation's been drawn down. Banks' reserve requirements have continued to be increased, so they can't loan as much. But still, the loan demand is out of control. I mean, it's just amazing how much money's being taken out of in loans, and the banks are just letting it it's very reminiscent, although it may not end the same way, of the incredible frenzy that went on back in 2004 to 2008 here and around the world. Matter. So what do you think about this IMF situation? You know,
you talk about the guy getting thrown in the slammer, the guy who's apparently had a reputation.
Mm-hmm.
Female journalists wouldn't refuse to interview him because he would apparently attack them. And there's a lot of negative stories. Of course, it all could be propaganda. But I don't see what the point of that would be, except for Sarkozy wanting to get...
Oh, yeah, that's clearly what it would be.
Yeah, well, Sarkozy wants to get a competitor out of the way because he was lined up to be the next head of France. He was supposed to take out Sarkozy easily, and then this happens, coincidentally. I mean, I agree that there's something fishy about it. But at the same time, apparently he had... If you listen to the communist... publications in France, when there's plenty of them, they all claim that this is a known situation with this guy. He apparently was a masher, and it's just a matter of, you know, so nobody doesn't believe this happened. They just are suspicious about the way it's being handled, and maybe it was a setup, but it was an easy guy to set up.
Timing was impeccable.
Yeah.
First of all, he was getting on a plane to go to Brussels to participate in a meeting that was the byproduct of an emergency situation from a couple of weeks back that Greece needed about $100 billion as a redo, part two of a bailout or restructuring. And he was pulled off the plane and DNA tested. He spent the night in Rikers Island. He's on suicide watch now.
I don't think that's necessary, but okay.
Okay.
But you probably would have to do that, yeah.
This is the guy who is running the International Monetary Fund.
Yeah.
We're talking about a very large bank.
Yeah.
That's handing out money all over the place, and a guy who has, let's just say, questionable scruples. Or questionable
morals, if nothing
morals,
else.
Morals, and this is the gentleman who is heading this up. That's concerning to me. I'm not suggesting that it's, you know, rampant. That throughout the entire IMF, this is going on, obviously, or anything of that nature. But boy, you got to scratch your head about that and wonder, you know, how this is, you know, how did we get this fellow to? I don't know. It's disturbing. So I don't know if now what's happening is that this opens the door once again for many of the BRIC countries, Brazil and China, India. They've wanted to be a much bigger part of the IMF for years, and this is going to open up the door for them to really protest and try to get in there.
Maybe.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. So with that in mind, so Portugal did still get their $100 billion bailout. It was approved. There's new talks for Greece. And you know my sentiment about the European and other, but the European leaders about how they say things that aren't exactly truthful, forthright.
Right.
So the new thing is that, you know, there was talk about a restructuring for Greek debt. Well, can't do that. Restructuring is a bad word, right? Because that means that there's going to be losers and there's going to be problems and write-downs. So we have a new word. It's either called a soft restructuring or a reprofiling of bonds.
I like reprofiling.
Reprofiling.
What does it mean?
It's a restructuring without calling it a restructuring, where private investors are going to take some of the voluntary loan extensions, okay? And this way, you're not going to have a default, thereby creating any kind of a automatic clause to pay off your CDS exposure. And I don't know. You know, it's the whole thing is bizarre. They call it a reprofiling, so it doesn't sound bad, I suppose. You don't call it printing money. You call it quantitative easing. Just come up with something else to confuse the hell out of people. I never heard of reprofiling. I must have made it up at the meeting.
Yeah. No, it's a good one.
Yeah, I like this. Soft restructuring still has the word restructuring in it, so that's no good.
Yeah, no. Reprofiling's better.
Yeah, we're going to reprofile. We're going to reprofile it, and that will definitely solve the problem. Just a quick reprofile. So that's good. A quick report. We're going to do that. We're just going to reprofile. And we may do, there's an opportunity, which is really good. We may do a secondary reprofiling one. And of course, the tertiary reprofiling would allow us to really make sure that there's concrete, backing behind all of it.
Right. You can reprofile the reprofiles.
Oh, whatever it means. Oh, it's so sad.
Hey,
so
talking sad. Of going back to that, you know, that guy who was predicting the S&P 400,
yeah.
He made mention of he says that foreign currencies are becoming more valuable, and so that's a good hedge. You should invest in foreign currency funds, for example, like maybe an ETF that has emerging market monetary vehicles within it.
Mm-hmm.
What is that? How does that work? It doesn't. When I would listen to him, and I'm shaking my head, saying this doesn't make any sense. Investing in, like, let's say the Brazilian real is going up in value against the dollar?
Mm-hmm.
Why would you want to invest in that, especially if all hell breaks loose and the dollar starts going up again? Wouldn't that be a bad investment?
Well, I guess according to his thesis, the entire U.S. situation is going to implode. And that being the case, everybody's going to run away from the dollar, and they're going to look for other assets, a place that are stronger. The only small crease in this argument is that if the United States goes to hell in a handbasket, I'm pretty sure, I'm not sure about this, but I'm pretty sure that the rest of the world is going to have a little bit of pain. And
I agree with that. I don't see the U.S. going down the toilet and everybody else having windfall profits because of it. It's all interlinked. It's bull crap.
It's total bull. It's ridiculous. It's a good thesis. It sounds good. Just like Peter Schiff, who talks about gold and silver, which, okay, you know, you've been right for a while on this. Don't get me wrong. But a lot of that has to do with the I don't want to call it voluntary, but the imposed by our own government dollar depreciation that's caused all these metals to move up in value. The dollar depreciation has been done not as much that other countries and other players are pulling out of the dollar because they think it's going to go down to zero. It's because they got the green light to borrow against it, to short it, to sell it, and buy riskier assets with the knowledge that it's being managed in the background. Much different, as you've seen the last number of days, when there's some concern about the economies, a hard landing in China, that they ran back into the dollar again. The dollar moved up 6% versus the euro in the last week and a half.
Yeah, which is a lot, considering.
It's unbelievable.
Yes, it's ridiculous. Well, which brings me to a secondary point, which is the Jim Rogers is on that series of videos on the Financial Times, and he just seems like the world's worst bear. Staying gold, and everything's ridiculous. We're printing too much money. All kinds of hyperinflation's coming. I mean, it's just like, the guys, I've always kind of liked to listen to him, but he just seems like he's beating a drum nobody else is beating.
Well, it's funny. He lives in Singapore, I believe. He moved there on purpose, and his whole idea is to teach his kids Mandarin, believing the world will be taken over by China one day.
Yeah, no, he talked about that. He said it's like it was weird. He says, as far as he's concerned, the best investment is in China, Chinese companies, and then when they go down, to buy more. Because right. He says he's going to be seen as a genius someday for saying this. And as he's saying this, I'm thinking the most corrupt companies are in China. There are a lot of them. There's companies being traded openly on their stock markets, which don't even exist. They're just paper companies that they're not even. There's nothing behind them. It's just a complete money laundering scam of some sort. And I just, of all the markets I think of as safe, China is not really on my list.
Not on the top of the list. Well, and he's also big into the whole idea of going back to an agrarian society. He thinks that's where we're headed. And he's big into the fertilizer stocks / food companies. He thinks that the whole destruction of material goods due to all of that's what's going to potentially happen is just, obvious to him. And, stay away from risk assets such as stocks and companies and things of that nature, financial assets. And just get into hard, assets that are backed by something. That's his basic thesis.
Like gold. He's a big gold bug.
Yeah, gold or silver or any kind of commodity or whatever it may be. Yeah, he's big into that. And he's one of the first that I recall way back when talking about globalization. Way back when. And he was right, clearly right, and that there was going to be a gigantic opportunity due to the growing emerging markets around the world, and especially Asia. He was right. But at the same time, there is hyperinflation in the areas he's in. The emerging Asian nations are just ridiculously inflate the assets are just inflating, and because of demand, a lot of demand. So he's an interesting fellow. He definitely has his own opinions. He's peculiar. Was he wearing a bow tie?
Yep. I've never seen him without a bow tie, which is not to be a bigot about this, but there's something wrong with people who wear bow ties in this, in this day and age. I mean, check the calendar. I mean, bow ties have been in and out of fashion. I think they were last fashionable in the mid-70s, something like that, and only for a short year or two. It's not a thing that you wear unless you got a tux on.
When you grow up in this generation or even the last generation, and somewhere along the line you get into the business world, and you wake up one day and say, I'm going to start wearing bow ties to work. No, seriously, what is that? You have to make that change at a given point, right? And you got to be thinking, I'm going to wear bow ties, and you're going to stick out, and it's going to be a strange thing. It's deciding in life to have a gigantic handlebar mustache.
Yeah, it's exactly the same, as a matter of fact, and it's a similar personality. Hiding places for the bow tie set are in publishing. You run into a lot of book publishers and some authors that feel that they should wear a bow tie because it has some sort of, some subtle subtext to it of you being literate. And
yes, you're smart.
Or smart, even though I don't see, to me, it doesn't indicate smart by any means. And so I've seen – you see these guys, they make it like their costume. They wear a bow tie.
And suspenders sometimes.
Yeah, it would makes it even worse. And so, yeah, I would agree. I think it's a judgment issue. So it's just like somebody who's got a tattoo on their face. They've decided to, you know, scratch their face up with a tattoo. I just find them to be people who have judgment issues.
And well, the bigger question is, do you ever unbow tie? I mean, now can you imagine him wearing a tie? You wouldn't know who he was.
No, and it would be out of... It would be bad. I mean, it would be, why is he not wearing a bow tie?
Yeah, something's wrong.
Because it's a costume. You start wearing a costume. It's like somebody always wears a red coat or always wears white, you know, or a big fedora hat. They always have
that. It's like Michael Jackson's glove.
Yeah, I know. I agree. I hate to go off on the deep end on the bow tie. But, yeah, I agree 100%. I think it's odd. And I don't know.
He's done well for himself, so what can you
say? Yeah, no, he's done very well, but I think to be honest about it, I think he's off the deep end.
So listen to this. LinkedIn, you know what that is, LinkedIn, right?
I'm a member.
You're a member. I know about LinkedIn because people constantly request me to be on LinkedIn, and I ignore it.
You've never joined.
I think I joined once upon a time when it first came out, and LinkedIn to me, and I could be totally wrong about this, okay? And I'm not a big, you know, stalker or anything like that on Facebook or user of these things per se. But LinkedIn to me seems like it's a place where it's a central repository for your business information so that if you ever need to find a job or you want people looking for you possibly to hire you, maybe a headhunter or whatever, it's on there. Am I incorrect about this?
I think that's exactly what it's for.
Okay. So they have it's also, let's call it the commercial Facebook. It's Facebook for business.
Well, actually, when it began, I'll give you the little background here. When it appeared on the heels of Friendster, and Friendster was supposed to be one of the original social networks that showed up on the internet that was designed for people to meet each other and date. And then LinkedIn came in for exactly the same model, but it was for people that wanted to look for jobs or hook up with people that employers, or they wanted to promote themselves or let people know that they were doing this or that, or they could go get a job as a marketing guy. It was a job oriented. Now, there was a short period of time there where Friendster was actually being used more for finding jobs and LinkedIn was being used for dating. But that, I think, has passed, and now it's pretty much a business. What you described, I think, is exactly what it is.
So they're coming to market in an IPO on Thursday. The symbol will be LNKD.
Yeah.
And what I do is, by the way, you never know exactly when an IPO is going to come out. So if you're wondering, how do I know? Well, there's a few things you could do. For example, like the day before or maybe even a couple of days before, you could try to see if maybe a Yahoo or a Google or whatever program you use to maybe track stocks has an alert system. You put the alert in that when it goes to a dollar, above a dollar, you get hit with that alert because you know it's going to trade above a dollar. So you know it starts trading.
Right.
So LinkedIn originally was coming to market at about $32 to $35 per share. So now with this new valuation between $42 and $45, if you take the midpoint, LinkedIn's value is going to be about $4 billion in total raised. $4 billion. For
raised?
LinkedIn.
They're actually going to get that in from the IPO?
If you calculate the amount of shares that are going to be, and they'll have $4 billion total. I mean, they're going to have treasury shares.
It was
too,
a big so deal when there was a $100 million deal. I mean, $4 billion who's going to buy this stock?
I mean, I don't know. We'll see what happens. I mean, we saw what happened with Renren. Renren moved up, and then that was the Chinese Facebook and slammed down. Came back a bit today. And actually, we nibbled that Renren last week or this week. Where are we ready? This week or last week? We nibbled on just a very, very small piece of Renren. Looking for it to bounce up from a very oversold situation. But you know, already we're hearing that Facebook, even though they said that an IPO was out a few years, has been speaking to various brokerage firms about a potential IPO. I think they're ready to, you know, they think this is hot at this point because it's starting to get a little bit frothy.
If I was them, I'd be all over it. Well, the getting's good.
All over it and then cash out and be done with it. But this guy, you know, is extremely
the LinkedIn guy?
No, I'm talking about the Facebook
Mark Zuckerberg.
He's an egomaniac, clearly, right? With more than aspirations to be
popular, king of the world.
Yeah, it's king of the world. It's clearly king of the world. When he came out the line that he said that Facebook was going to be an OS, remember that? That Facebook would be, I was like, uh-oh. That was a couple of years ago. But, you know, at this point, I would just take the money and go. I don't know what else you're going to do.
Yeah. Well, I think the same thing with the LinkedIn guys. That might be an interesting. I'm going to put that one as a short. I thought it was going to be a $15 stock. I didn't know it was going to start off at $45 or so. I mean, that's not going to cut it.
Crazy. I think the numbers are nuts. I don't know what the revenues are, but that number is it's got to be out of whack. And you know, we talked about these reverse mergers with Chinese firms recently, talking about these kind
right.
of crazy stuff.
Yeah.
Well, there's been a new discussion that a lot of these are going to be pulled off the U.S. stock exchange voluntarily by some of these companies and relisted over in Hong Kong. So I wonder if
why?
Because they're getting no respect here, and they obviously are being, you know, many players are seeing through the farce. So I think they'll just move it over there, and hopefully they'll get some traction.
They might.
You can fool some people here, some people there. Talking about fiascos. You see what's going on with RIM, Research in Motion?
That poor guys.
I mean, I can't believe that. I mean, I can't believe it, but they're recalling a bunch of the playbooks because of faulty OS startup and issues and all that. I mean, that's bad.
Well, I got the biggest kick out of the follow-up report, which says none of these were actually in the hands of consumers. They were just in the channel. I don't think they've sold any.
Well, right. They say they're recalling 1,000, which I think could possibly be 100%.
Yeah, the entire shipment, all of them. I think recalling 1,000 from the channel, none of them have been sold. Yeah, no, that it's very possible.
Yeah, when the Apple iPad came out, you saw them everywhere, didn't you? I mean, immediately. Not only did you see them everywhere, but did you notice that people were sitting with it in a way that it was kind of like their own little bow ties?
Oh, yeah. You know, look at what I've got. Oh, I was in a plane recently, and some old woman, actually, a very old lady, had one of these things, and she had it at some angle that everybody in the airplane had to see it. She's in the aisle seat, and she was holding it just damn near over the aisle. I mean, it was ridiculous, and she was playing, I don't know, Angry Birds or something stupid.
Right. So, that is a fun game for 5 minutes. Then it gets really annoying. So that's happening. Then we have, of course, the situation with Starbucks, which is great, that they're not going to be buying coffee anymore. They refuse to buy coffee at these high prices.
Well, good for them.
Yeah, I don't know what they're going to do.
But by the way, they're a coffee company. What are they going to do? Sell chocolate?
Yeah, I guess they have a pretty good stock.
Oh.
And I don't know this answer. Maybe one of our listeners knows about how much coffee farms potentially that Starbucks owns directly or indirectly, or not? Because you would think that the size they are and the amount of coffee that they sell, you would think they should own Colombia for that matter. You know, they should own some.
Yeah, they should own a country.
Yeah, and they could probably do so if only Greece were able to grow coffee.
You'd have something.
Yeah, because you could. I think they really need to sell Santorini.
That would work.
Or Mykonos. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, then you raise capital, you sell assets off. That's what you do. So, you know, what are you going to sell? You're going to sell the Acropolis? You know, what are you going to sell the Colosseum, whatever it is, the Pantheon, Parthenon, whatever's over there? I don't know. Speaking of coffee, you ever have their coffee there, the Turkish coffee? You ever have that?
Yeah.
You chew it.
Well, they leave the grounds in there, yeah.
Yeah, but if you don't know the first time, you take a slug of it. You're like, what is that? Like, what just happened?
Good.
It's in your teeth.
You know, not to change the subject, because we have to look at our stocks now, but I was in Indonesia and Malaysia once, and I guess I just drink nothing but straight some of the world's greatest Sumatran coffee. The coffee quality of the coffee in those countries is so unbelievable that it stops you in your tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had good coffee all over the place, but not where you just regular coffee. That's just you just stop and go, my God, what is this?
And then it ruins you for the rest of your life, coffee anywhere else.
Well, you definitely remember it. Anyway, so let's take a look at our stocks.
Let's take a look. Let's go to the stock list. Let me go over here. Let me go over here to the documents. Okay, yeah, there's a few things that we have to obviously note that were stopped out. It's been one of those weeks.
Look at
that,
this ultra short silver. You hit another 60% and then it was that's the one that you were out of.
And then we went in and out of again, stopped out again. We went again into it. We made another 8%.
Yeah. Probably should have.
We
just
only lost on the long.
Yeah. Well, that was a win.
Actually, no, we'd be better off. We'd better off trading because it's trading below that. So that worked out perfectly. But the ProShares Ultra Short Oil is up 8.8% from last week as well.
Yeah, that's something.
So you see that our list is starting to thin out a little bit.
Yeah, we need some new ideas.
Ascena stopped out at 128. It's now at about 115. It was down at 104, 105 2 days ago. Rubicon, what a disappointment. The numbers came out beautiful. The outlook was beautiful. And then the LED stock just got cremated. And I got to tell you, very disappointing. It was down another 5% today. I think Citi downgraded the LEDs. But as a sector,
why?
Meanwhile, you know, due to lack of demand, higher pricing, global slowdown,
they
blah, blah, blah.
They got to
get
the prices down. You know, those things are supposed to cross over at this point. I think what kept the prices high. By now, they should have crossed over the cost per watt and per unit. With fluorescence, so there should be like no fluorescent lights being sold anymore because LED lighting is supposed to be cheaper and more efficient and everything in between, but apparently not.
Well, the big problem is that if you are in an older facility, an office or whatever, you can't just screw it in. You have to get a new receptacle. You have to get a new entire unit, right? So
no.
That is – what do you mean no? How, you just put it in a fluorescent – tubing.
Oh, the fluorescence. Yeah, the fluorescence are a problem. But regular screw-in bulbs.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you can make LED deals out of that. I mean, I have an LED bug light in front of the house, and it's cost, you know, $10 for the light.
It's like yellow?
That. Yeah.
Yeah. So the thing about Rubicon is a good, it's a perfect instrument to take a look at something in that even a stock that's potentially showing good signs of potential growth in the short term, good earnings. When you're caught up in a industry that may be in trouble, and even if it's the leader in the industry, by the way, in a stock market that's rolling over, that down, you know, 4% on the Russell 2000, technology's been down, energy has been really crushed, et cetera, and the markets have been down only 3%, but I got to tell you, a lot of stocks are getting crushed. Even the best stocks can get slammed. And I think that's a perfect lesson to look at that, you know, why during clear market corrections, you want to be careful what you invest in. Very, very careful. Because you can get hurt pretty easily. So anyway, there was rumor today that Adobe Systems was going to be bought by Microsoft. That rumor is an old rumor that keeps on popping up every once in a while.
Yeah, it pops up a lot. That would be a funny situation that I can't imagine happening.
I would love Apple to buy Adobe just to put this whole damn thing to sleep.
Yeah,
right.
Apple and Adobe have had feuds recently. The problem is that Adobe essentially, as long as Warnock is, I think, still chairman and some other old-timers are in there, they're not going to do anything with these two companies.
Yeah. Right. The Legg Mason came down. One of the things that's happening is Meredith Whitney has once again reestablish her point on municipals being in bad, bad straits, that the pension plans, if you really look at the amount of requirements for pension plans and if you look at the amount of money that's coming in tax receipts, it's very, very lopsided. And one of the things, the reason, the thesis was that with Legg Mason is they have a gigantic municipal bond portfolio. If you look at the fund flows, if you look at a spreadsheet that shows money in, money out of various types of mutual funds over the last several months, the number one out has been municipal bonds. Mm. So they're hurting because – they're not getting hurt that badly. I mean, but they're hurting because they are in that genre of losing money because – losing fees because of that. But I'll also share one other thing to you. I think this is a side note, but – I got the prospectus today on the Schwab U.S. Treasury money market that's paying 0.1% on deposits. Okay? Now, this is used as what we call a sweep account for clients. So let's say that you have 50% invested, 50% cash, for whatever reason, in your account. So on the 50% in cash, you're getting 0.1% in the U.S. Treasury fund, right? Do you know what the fees are, the management fees for that fund that Schwab gets is?
2.2.
0.6.
Oh, geez. So you lose 0.5.
No, no. You net. You do net 0.1. That's the net.
Oh, the net is 0.1. Okay.
Yeah. Now, mind you, they also are waiving about 15 basis points. So the real fee is 0.75.
It's ridiculous.
So think about that, though. I mean, that's an amazing thing. That's where all these companies make all their money, by the way. When interest rates go up, they even have a better spread. So what you'll see, the Schwabs, and they make great money with the fees on those money markets. The money market's the big, big money maker for them. Anyway, so we got stopped out on that. Acme Packet, you got stopped out. Glue Mobile, epic disappointment. Epic disappointment. That's the second
you'll
time.
You'll be back in it, I can tell.
Yeah, second time around on that. And then otherwise, I mean, cruising along with Metro and Alexa. Everything is kind of hanging in. IBM is yours. Almost at an all-time high again, very close. And you want to put in LinkedIn, right?
Yeah, I do, actually. I want to short it.
Yeah, I'll find out what the symbol and when it comes out and when it's short. You're going to short it on the open, or are you going to wait till a certain time? I would suggest to you that you wait for about, I would say about a half hour to an hour after it comes out.
So you think it's going to take a little up because it's going to be, you know, a fake demand. They're going to try to boost it. And then it's going to collapse.
I don't know if it's going to collapse.
If the short works, I mean, this is like
the short works. It will be after
the Tesla. We played this with Tesla.
LNKD. Yep. LNKD. Let me look at this.
All right. I think that's good. Go for give it a little room. Maybe hour. Yeah, hour and a half.
LNKD. Enter it into here. Now this is the spreadsheet that we use over at Google. You get this from going to DH Unplugged, and you just click on the spreadsheet. And, of course, any things we talk about here are not recommendations to buy anything. And I say that every time. Seriously, do your own research. Check it out. This little game that we play, just to, some of the interesting things that may be appearing in the markets right now. And, this is just something to kind of check out and to follow along. And I encourage you to follow along because it's kind of fun to watch, you know, what's happening with these with some of these stocks. So
I think the curious little game I'm playing here is the Intel versus ARM.
Yeah.
Which is already spreading a little bit here, more than I expected.
And there was an announcement, I think it was today, that Microsoft's going to start using ARM and separating they're going to have seven different operating systems that are going to be sharing different kinds of processors, and they're going to be using ARM for the mobile platforms, et cetera, and they're going to be using the Intel processors for the others, and maybe the AMDs. But that's, I thought it was kind of interesting.
They played this game once before. They tried anyway. They did. They claimed they were going to do all these. It was for Windows NT.
Yeah. Oh, remember that?
They were going to bring out Windows NT on the PowerPC chip and on the one of the other chips. I can't remember the name. It was an obscure chip company in Silicon Valley. They ended up making media processors. For some reason, the name eludes me. They were going to do that one, and then the Intel chips. And I think there may have been a fourth company. They were going to, so it was going to be portable all over the place. And then, this was. Then they lost interest. I mean, I know for a fact that they had PowerPC versions of Windows NT running because they were showing it at the show in Taiwan, right. Behind closed doors. And then they said, too much work.
Yeah. Well, I have a stock. I'm reluctant to go long right now when we're seeing a lot of distribution go on, and even though it may pick up from here. But there's two different ones I was thinking about. One is the solar company I talked about a few times. It's rating very high on our score system. It's called GT Solar. A little bit different than the other solars in that they are, I guess the difference is, if you look at it in a way, the difference between an AMAT, Applied Materials, that makes the semiconductor equipment makers, right? They supply that side of it, versus an Intel, right? So one is they're both kind of semiconductors. One's manufacturing, one's end product. It's kind of the same.
Intel buys from Applied Materials.
Right. So, and then the second thing would be C-Trip. I did an analysis of their earnings last night. The earnings came out. They beat. There was a question about their management's guidance. Stock was down 4% after their earnings. They're the price line of China, and there's only one or two of them, Elong and C-Trip, main ones. And C-Trip has had a great run. Its earnings stream has been fantastic. The big concern that I saw was that they are guiding a little bit lower, but they're very conservative usually in their guidance. And if you use how much they usually beat by, you know, we're coming up with a price target that's much higher. We did a full analysis of this yesterday. So, you know, it's a little bit under pressure now due to that, but I think it's possible that you may see some analyst recommendations coming in on C-Trip.
Why don't you put that on there? Let's put it on.
I'll put C-Trip on there long. I think it's an interesting play, even though China may be slowing down. But I think that C-Trip still has a great opportunity there. I think some of these Chinese names have been beaten up terribly. Renren's the other one I would kind of look into. But we'll put C-Trip and LinkedIn on the score sheet here. Hey, one more thing, a couple more things. You and I actually are going to be talking with John Perkins this week.
Yeah, on your show.
On the Discipline Investor podcast. That will be appearing next Sunday night, late. It will be airing. But we're going to be talking to John Perkins, who is the author of Hoodwinked, as well as – I think we sent you – hopefully we sent that to you.
I got all the documents, okay. Yeah.
Yep, so we sent you that. And also Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And I want to ask him about the potential behind the recent Libyan, Egyptian / Middle East conflicts and how we're involved in that potentially for oil again. Because he's all about that.
Yeah, but he's backing off on the oil thing, which I'm slightly suspicious of in claiming that the I read all those documents, claiming that the reason for the Libyan attacks were because of this phony baloney dinar, a gold dinar attempt by Gaddafi to make the gold dinar a international currency to compete with the dollar. I'm just not buying that one, and he doesn't think it's about oil, so we'll see. We'll see what he says.
We'll talk to him this week. You know who else I talked to? I talked to Andrew Ross Sorkin this week, who wrote the book Too Big to Fail, and he also is a New York Times columnist, et cetera, CNBC contributor. And they made his book into a HBO special, a movie with some very big actors. Paul Giamatti plays Bernanke. Great. If you look
great
at the previous,
casting.
Great. It's great.
I wonder if he's going to bitch about Merlot.
Maybe. I think – is it William Hurt? No, William Hurt. I think it's William Hurt. Plays Paulson. A great, great, great character list. And that's going to be coming out on the 21st on HBO. So I talked to him this week about it. It was kind of an interesting discussion. And if people want to listen to that, it's kind of a fun thing to watch. By the way, I just looked. And the number one story on Bloomberg is – the number one red story? The watermelons.
Really?
Yeah, the most popular story is about watermelons in China.
Brother. Unbelievable.
Crazy stuff. All right, I will see you next Tuesday, and we'll talk this week with John Perkins.
Yeah, talk to you then. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
You've been listening in on a conversation with John C. Dvorak and Andrew Horowitz. Hope to be with you again soon. Bye-bye.
Now, I'm not broke, but badly bent. I'm not down to my last cent, 'cause I got a dollar, but it's my last dollar bill. Yes, sir. In my pockets, there's a dent. All my dough is nearly spent, but I got a dollar, and it's my last dollar bill. Oh, I'd love just one more buck fortune left me by chance. Now, here's a hint, I feel like a mint. You can hardly tell by a glance. I don't care, no millionaire can give me the icy stare, 'cause I got a dollar, my last dollar bill.